You're going just old Jackie Robinson there, just knocking it out of the park, knocking it out of the park. That's the way we do it in New York.
Yeah, I warned you, we're recording now.
You want to switch roles a little bit?
Sure.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Redacted Podcast. My name is Jake with Gridbase, and I'm sitting here with...
Oh, yes. My name is Forrest. I'm supposed to be the host.
Go right on ahead. Take it from there. I just always wanted to do that part.
You know, it's great. So let's kick it off. Jake, it's great to have you back on the show. I've been
Thank
looking
you.
Forward to this conversation since SHOT Show because you introduced this concept almost 4 months. It's about 4 months ago now. And my generational tardiness has been incapable of getting you on until now, but we will move on from there. So, Jake, I'm very excited to have this chat with you. So I'm going to do your thing. Gridbase is a company that I've, and you, is a company that I've known for a little while, and you guys provide off-grid communications and technology tools. That's going to be the let's call it the layman's version of what you do. So give us a short description, and then I'll jump in from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on once again. You know, you were one of the very first people to see what Gridbase was over a year ago, and you really helped shape the language that we use today in describing what Gridbase does. And so I really appreciate you for that, you know, and of course, we've since developed a personal friendship and it's become much more than just business. But I wanted to just say thank you for platforming us early on and for helping us shape what it is exactly that we do. So what it is exactly that we do is we focus on decentralization. If it's decentralized, that's our mission and that's what we do. So what I mean when I say that is that pulling out control from large corporations, I think already within the... the gun culture 3.0, you know, there was like, hey, we shouldn't just let cops defend our families. We should be able to have a right to do that as well. So we're already familiar with this concept of decentralization, right? We don't want to relinquish our power in some of these fundamental, what we believe, freedoms to other people. We want to be able to have control over that. So I think the gun culture world might understand decentralization through that framework a lot easier. But we've just kind of continued to scale that and to say, you know what? Information too, right? Like we shouldn't be beholden to Google and the AI garbage that's with on there for our for all of our information. And we shouldn't have to have an internet server room that's like held in a Microsoft Azure cloud. Like we should be able to have more information than that. But of course, it's really difficult to remove one's self from the convenience of the internet. And so that's what we do. We make products that take all of the benefits of having a giant library of every single thing that you could possibly want and need, such as Wikipedia and survival manuals and ham radio, you know, information and, how to fix your vehicle, the whole iFixit manual. We've just taken the best parts of the internet for all things community rehabilitation and sustainment. We've packaged them into a product that allows you to use it much like you would the internet. So you can search some of these things and do all of that. And since then, we've become kind of synonymous with some radio stuff in the radio sphere a little bit because the products we make are the information side of things, and then the knowledge that we provide and the content that we provide for radios is the communication side of things. And so I don't want any other man standing between me and calling my wife, right? Like I want to be in control of being able to get a hold of my wife, and I want my wife to be able to have her own autonomy and being able to get a hold of me. And so we use radios to do that because no one can stand in the middle of that, right? Whereas we recently had a cell phone outage. You know, there's the world over, there's been internet outages. It's pretty common. India is notorious for it during election years. India is notorious for having these internet outages. Germany too. So the United States is really the only country that's just started to have these infrastructure collapses. Other countries have been facing them for a long time, even first world countries such as Germany, whether they're by design or malicious is really neither here or there. It's just the fact that your access to these things can be limited by someone else other than you. So that's it, man. Decentralization. Own your ability to do things instead of giving it to large corporations. And people always ask me, well, where do I start with that? Wherever you can, wherever it's most important. Is it food? You know, one example is like stocking a deep freeze full of meat and canned goods and whatever. Like that somewhat insulates you from having to go to the grocery store every time you need food. Right. And so, of course, the scaled version of that would be having a farm with cows and chickens and all of that. But in the interim, when we don't have a farm with cows and chickens, even just stockpiling food can be a good thing to limit your immediate need upon some of those large corporations that may fail you, or the, you know, semi trucks that can't get to it because a bridge was wrecked into by a ship, you know, and now your grocery stores don't have any food in them. You know, there's all kinds of reasons why decentralization is important, and there's all kinds of ways for someone to get tapped into decentralization. So if you're into that, then you're into Gridbase.
Awesome. I have so many things that I want to approach on that one, but let's start with this. And I think that is, to the empire, decentralization looks like collapse. But what you're talking about, and of that whole conversation, let's say that whole piece you said about not having any middleman between you and your wife, that I think is going to be the most resonating for sure. I remember in 2020, my wife and I were living in Minneapolis, and this is the George Floyd Summer of Love jokes. But there was a grocery store across. We were at the third precinct when they burned it down. When the rioters and the looters burned it down, the third precinct, and across the street from it was a grocery store, and that was the primary food grocery store of the neighborhood. And that one, there were people trying to light that on fire, and they had already looted a whole bunch of stuff. And so it was kind of like, it become like the convenience store stopping campground for anyone who's doing shenanigans in that area. And you know, the sad thing about it, and the sad thing about that problem, is it doesn't really matter whether it's malicious or environmental, let's call it, like whether it's a tsunami, a hurricane, a natural disaster, or a man-made disaster. It doesn't really matter who's at fault when you cannot communicate with your wife, because the only method of communication you have requires an infrastructure that was just taken down because of a fluke accident. And I think that's what true terror can feel like. So, well done, dude. That's awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, susceptibility. You know, everything's susceptible. Just making yourself less susceptible, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And you know, you said it looks like, what did you say right at the beginning of that? It looks like decay, right?
To the empire, decentralization looks like collapse.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's, it strikes me as interesting that you put it that way, because like in my life and the way that I live and think, I'm only really reaching back like 20 years, you know, and I talk often about device specificity. So like there was an era during the era of like transparent electronics casings where, you know, everybody had like device specificity. So you had a TomTom for your GPS, or maybe you like printed off a MapsQuest, you know, you had an iPod or an iPod Shuffle or something for your music. And you had just all these different specified devices. And it was
I grew up in that area, man.
Yeah, exactly. I did too. And so I think about this stuff as like, man, it really wasn't that. I mean, you could go back, of course, to the 50s and 60s and say like, well, everyone was a ham radio operator then. But I mean, you could go back even shorter than that to like the early aughts or the late 90s and say like, decentralization wasn't a word because we just already were, you know? And so, yeah, I just think it's interesting because it's like we don't have to reach that far back. It's really cool, I think. We don't have to reach that far back to like get back to some of these things. You know, we know them. They're within our DNA to decentralize. You know, we have the tools there. There's, you know, an iPod Shuffle or a Garmin on eBay, like a Garmin TomTom type navigation tools, like $20 on eBay. So how cool? You know, we can have a specified device for navigating us that's not dependent on any cell towers. Of course, it's dependent upon GPS, but there's not really a way of getting around that. But, you know, I think it's really cool that we're in this era right now where like old tech like that from that era is like so cheap and available, and we can go and have access to it. And I have all of those things. And it's great because when my phone rings and I'm driving, my GPS doesn't get interrupted. My music doesn't get interrupted. You know, like my GPS is its own thing. My tape's in the tape deck. I listen to tapes in the Cadillac. And I just pick up my phone and answer it, or I'm on the radio, you know? And so it's like plugging back into that decentralized lifestyle has been so amazing because, and man, I'll just tell a quick story the other day. More and more, I'm leaving my house without my phone. It's not required. My wife has me on comms in the Cadillac. Most of my friends now are ham radio operators, and they're all on the radio too. I have a wonderful tape collection. So for music, you know, I'm mostly listening to Sade in the tape deck. I really don't listen to any other tape. And Sade Promise. And, but you know, there's still the internet thing. Well, anyway, I was driving past an H2 Hummer, and I've never thought H2s were cool, right? H1s were cool, Humvees were cool, but I never thought H2s were cool. And the other day I was in the Cadillac and I was running errands. I didn't have my phone and I drove past an H2. And for some reason I was like, dude, this H2 is really cool. Why do I feel that way about this H2? And then I was like, oh man, you know what would rule it out as being cool in my mind is if it had a V6. I wonder if it had a V6 or a V8. Well, I didn't have my phone on me to look that up, but I keep the base station in my car mounted. And so I was like, oh, I already thought of this. So I went into Wikipedia on the base station while I was at a stoplight, and I typed in H2 Humvee in the offline Wikipedia repository that we have, and it told me that it was a V8, and it told me everything about the H2. And I was like, how stinking cool, because like just now I did absolutely everything that I needed to do completely independent of anything else, you know, other than GPS and the GPS satellites. But like that's pretty okay to me, you know. And yeah, man, it's doable. It's doable. You can do it today, you know. And it was just a really cool moment where, you know, because I'm the proctor of this thing, I use it so much and I'm so inundated with it. It's not that often where I get to just use it because of my own curiosities and my own involvement. So I think that's why it struck me as so neat, because like I got to be, for like one of the first times in a long time, I got to have the experience that the end users of my products are having.
Now, I'm very excited to announce the first official sponsor of the Redacted Culture Cast. Obsidian Arms is one of those companies that reflects the many facets of gun culture. Not only are their firearms frequently found on competition fields like USPSA and 3-Gun, but they are a Minnesota-based, US-sourced original equipment manufacturer. Obsidian Arms makes their own punch and tool kits for the amateur and professional gunsmith out of Little Canada, Minnesota, that come with a lifetime warranty. Whether it is fine parts that require a Swiss machine, or you're in the design phase and are looking for an American machine shop that is in tune with the needs of gun culture, go check out Obsidian Arms at obsidianarms.com. Thank you, and now back to the show. Let's go back to decentralization, something that I appreciate about you, and that there's a conversation that you and I have been having, and I think the gun industry has been having, and the gun culture has been having, and the people in this country have been having over and over and over and over again, and that is about the black pill, and about this idea that you know, the world is, it's not necessarily that the world is coming to an end, but maybe like the West is coming to an end, and it can be represented in movies like Civil War by A24, which we've done an episode on. It can be about preparing for a change in the environment, like imagining Fallout's popular again, you know, the video game. And the thing about it, and the thing that I've been challenged by, it has to do a lot with perspective. Like one of them has to be, in some cases, in many cases, the obsession of preppers, what we call preppers, getting ready for the apocalypse or the SHTF environment, whatever it is, there tends to be something a little distasteful about it. But I don't want to, this isn't intended to be like a character assassination. Rather, what I've come to recognize is that the apocalypse is kind of like sugar in the morning. If you think about nutrition, the food that you eat is either going to be short-term fun, long-term possibly detrimental, or it might be something, a better source of energy is something that's going to carry you through the day. And apocalypticism, or obsession with the collapse or the decentralization as collapse kind of mentality, it seems to function quite a bit like sugary cereal in the morning. It doesn't really carry people onto a meaningful or more, even perhaps even moral lifestyle. There was another great show, which is Dirty Civilian, did a episode on the morality behind the idea of civil war, and one of their constant resounding notes was that you want to be prepared in a sense, you want to be prepared in the event that something happens so that you do not become the immoral person, which is a very different way, a very different moral foundation than I want to survive. And survival is such an odd concept in the sense of it's just what we assume as the base human instinct. Like, we just want to survive. And unfortunately, I think it comes from a little bit of neo-Darwinism, but I don't think it sustains people very well. Like, when you look at cataclysmic events taking place all around the world, it's not about it. It very quickly doesn't become about survival. It's just people killing each other for the sake of vengeance or fun or entertainment. And then the assumption that one is there just to survive doesn't hold up very well against water. And so as you were talking through your company and how you've been growing GridBase and many of your motivations and even your story of I can be in communication with my wife with no middleman, or you can research a vehicle, you can do on the ground, in the field, research about things in your environment. It changed the, I appreciate something that you bring to the table, which is a sense of optimism as opposed to very much so a pessimistic worldview. But you said something at SHOT Show, and I'm going to paraphrase it as best as I can, and then I'm going to ask you to fill it out, and that goes something like this. The level of dysfunction in our country, in America, is not evenly matched by the amount of dissatisfaction. In other words, if we take the population of the country, not only is it an election year, which is going to add its own flavor, but there's certainly no shortage of dissatisfaction with the way things are going. Certain Christian circles have been talking about, the country needs to return to God. The right has been talking about this, that, and the other. You've got even conversations with James Lindsay and the Marxification of the youth. And you've got the left talking about fascism and tyranny and all this other problems. And it seems like the attitude has shifted from when I was a child, and this might just be my own perspective, from there are challenges, but we'll make it through, to it's definitely going to fall apart. And the assumption is that it's just falling apart. And so you brought a challenge to that notion, and I want to hear you.
Please.
Remind
me. Let me rip here. So let's talk about the notion, first of all. There's a $1 trillion operation going on to make people feel that way, okay? And whether that's... And let me rewind a little bit. Let me just... None of what I'm going to say is going to discount the way anyone feels about this, right? Like, what people are saying about that kind of stuff is true, okay? Like, our nation is in decline through a certain lens. Not going to argue that, right? When millions of people flood your country and, you know, like, you have all these crazy policies in schools and stuff like that are damaging to people's children, not only during their time in school, but for life or whatever, like... Yeah, that's bad. Okay, I'm never gonna argue that. I'm not even arguing anything. I'm providing a perspective that is simply this: there's an operation going on to make you more consumed with the world at large than your own community, and whether that be because of whether that's intentional, you know, by people, or whether that's just a product of the advent of the internet, where we're more connected than we ever were, is really also neither here or there. It's just a fact that, like, now we have more information about what's going on in Ukraine than we do about what's going on at our city council budget meeting. And, you know, that ultimately leads to the consumption of this information by individuals. And then that's what individuals talk about. And it's kind of this, like, negative feedback loop about all this other stuff that is going on with the world at large. But, like, I'm going to sit here and tell you right now, like, my son is fine. My son's never seen an iPad. My son does not watch Bluey. my son, you know what I mean? Like, I'm raising my son. He goes outside and stomps in mud and pees himself right now because we're potty training. So it's like, whatever's going on with other people's children and whatever's going on within the school system and all those kinds of things is important. But for me and my family and what I'm focused on, nobody's coming into my house and forcing me to, like, you know, declare my son's gender today or ever. You know, I do have the benefit of living in Texas, and I recognize that privilege. God bless Texas. But, you know, like, those kinds of things are not real for me. And I think that this negative feedback loop about the society at large is also perpetuated by companies who are profiteering off of fear-based propaganda, where they are investing into this echo chamber of the world's ending, and or content creators that want to jump in, and that, you know, that kind of stuff gets clicks because it's validating to people who are having these conversations that feel like they're not supposed to be allowed to have. And so, you know, whether it's because of the social media machine, or whether it's because of the marketing tactics of companies who sell products, or whether it's because of the fact that, you know, all of our media is owned by BlackRock or whatever, like, there's just this large operation going on to make people connected with this doom and gloom thing. And it's paired with our own mortality obsession of, like, knowing when the end is. So we as humans have this, like, thing where we want to know where the end, like, when's the end? When's the end for me? And we've been obsessed with that from the beginning of time. It's a human condition thing. So, you know, that's why it's a really effective marketing campaign to market on that, because it's hitting, like, a base level, low vibrational, immediate click buy, you know, make a purchase, you know, sales funnel. And so, but what I'm saying at large is that, you know, I want to give this example here. So for those who are not familiar, in New Hampshire, there's something called the Free State Project, which is a really interesting movement. It was founded in 2001, and it simply aims at encouraging liberty-minded individuals to move to New Hampshire and promote limited government and individual freedoms. The project gained attention for its ambitious goal of attracting 20,000 liberty-oriented activists to the state to influence policies and create a freer society. It was founded, or credited to be founded, by Jason Sorens, who's a political scientist who proposed the idea that in an essay titled The Strategy of Liberty, the Free State Project, Sorens envisioned a concentrated effort where like-minded individuals could have a significant impact on local policies, and his idea gained traction, leading to the formal launch of the Free State Project within New Hampshire. Now, I have a buddy who drives around with a Barrett 50 cal attached to the top of his 99 Jeep Rubicon that he's never registered. And he homeschools his kids in New Hampshire. Okay, so in 2001, a group of libertarians got together and got involved in their city to make it to where you don't have to register your car. There's extremely lenient firearms laws. There's absolutely no, there's like vouchers, so you can send your kid to whatever school you want to. And if you want to homeschool your kid, you can. And, you know, cannabis is legal. There's a ton of civil liberties. There's limited taxation. There's unlimited school choice, right? And so, like, actively today, the Free State Project is going on within New Hampshire. And it's an example of what can happen when people plug out of, like, all the craziness that people want you to buy into and plug into their local communities. And so the system, I would say, is not functionally broken, right? Our morality is broken, and we don't have God in this country, and, like, all those things are true, and our borders are broken, and we have really terrible policies that are really not left or right. This is not a left and right conversation. These are just facts. And, you know, what I'm positioning is that, or how you said it, or how I said it in Vegas, whoever said it, was that the level of dissatisfaction does not match the level of dysfunction. What that really means is that you can get together with people in your communities and use the system and use the regulations and use the process to your advantage within your communities locally. Have you been to your city council budget meeting? Do you know what they're spending money on? Do you have a group that can go and lobby against maybe them putting flock cameras up in your city or whatever, right? There's an opportunity functionally for people to make a change within their city and within their community. And we talk about community all the time, like, go and meet your neighbors. But it's like, go and meet your neighbors with a political agenda to go get involved in city council to change the way that things are. People love power. These people want their seats. So if their constituents are showing up in enough numbers and we're saying that, hey, if you want us to vote for you again, these are the kinds of policies that we want to see enacted within our local community, that's how this stuff works. So obviously at a larger scale, you know, we can't compete with lobbying. We can't go. Citizens United has already been, you know, decided upon. So like we can't do anything about those things immediately right now today. But we can immediately right now today start drumming up support for new and interesting ideas within our community locally. And I believe that that local impact is what people have lost sight on. And I don't necessarily think it's their fault. Like I said, I think it's a part of a larger operation to keep people distracted and to keep people feeling defeated. Let's make sure that kids feel like they can't afford homes. Let's spike the interest rates to where it'd be impossible for them to ever own a home. You know, let's just wipe out the morale of everyone entirely. And then they'll just be so inundated with all this information that they'll just sit like ducks and wait for whatever comes, you know? And it's like, there's another option.
So there is a, we're going to have to break this into parts, and I wish I had more note paper to like start diagramming it. And I wish I was smarter with tech to be able to even do it on the screen, but let's start with this. So the first things there's like nine or not nine different parts, but there's a couple different parts. One of them is intentional versus unintentional. And what I mean by that is we're going to talk about the, What we're really doing right now is we're building a worldview, not just a perspective of current events, but what you've been talking about is quite literally just a worldview of how do you perceive the mechanism of the world to be true and functioning, and also what are you have a moral component to it, what you ought do versus what is going on, and you have localization. But I want to start with, and the fourth thing or fifth thing or whatever it is in that list is it has to do with like motivation. And so I want to start there. I want to start with epistemology. And that begins with the mechanism of belief. Because we have to consider for a moment why people believe things, how it is that they come to believe certain things. Especially when it's narrative level ideas, because you're talking about this idea that the world, the environment that we live in is hopeless or whatever it is. And the mechanism of belief has been debated for thousands of years, and it also changes kind of like paradigms. Thomas Kuhn, paradigm, this is where we get the idea of paradigm shift. And he wrote a book in the 60s called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which argues that science is not an ever-growing line in linear development, but it has paradigms that could be described as the base the assumed foundational beliefs for that paradigm. So Newtonian physics, Einsteinian, blah, 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 Euclidean geometry, these kind of eras, almost you can think of them as like eras or periods of time within what you might refer to as the scientific community as the assumed foundational beliefs. And so what that means now and what that means in regards to what we're talking about is what is the mechanism of belief? Sometimes people believe things not because they think they're rational, but because it makes them feel good. We don't like this. It includes ourselves, but it's not like a socially pleasing thing to hear when I say, oh, when I investigate my own mind or my own beliefs and I realize that I believe something not because I think it's true and that there's evidence to support it or that there's something else, it's I believe it because I want it to be true, that's not a fun feeling. But it is a required, it's an important thing for us to do. And I think there is a payback, a benefit for believing. I'm not saying a benefit in a good way, but there is a benefit for having a perspective of the world that it is all falling apart in a horribly negative way. Like this It can be summed up into, let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. If the world is falling apart, if the West is collapsing, if the country is screwed, then we are not morally obligated to live righteous lives. Because there's no point to it. There's no point to doing the right thing, getting a job or working hard or developing a company or building
starting a garden,
because it's all gonna, like, if you know that you're gonna get hit by a nuke tomorrow, let's bring in the Fallout reference. If I know that tomorrow I'm going to, that my specific neighborhood is gonna get hit by a nuclear bomb, I'm not gonna go prune my lime tree. I'm not gonna go water my garden. I'm not gonna go take care of my home. I'm just
gonna hasten the demise.
Yeah, and so, but like now extrapolate that into something like the country as a whole. If it's all falling apart, why should I try? Why should I participate in community living?
Apathy has been the goal. Apathy has been their goal to get you to be apathetic. That's been, whoever the they is, that's been their goal from day one, was apathy.
Well, apathy would be then, if you were going to use another way of phrasing it, becoming apathetic is becoming an intellectual casualty. Let's make an assumption that there is a they. I have a hard time. This is going to be the operational side of it. But if there's a they, I want names, faces, and addresses. Like, if there is a person, right? So, like, and this is an important, it's a really important distinction for the way that even gun culture talks about the use of force is like,
point of privilege.
Go ahead.
All right. So John D. Rockefeller is credited in the late 20s and early 30s with developing the modern education system as we know it today. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
So, and he's known for having said that, I want workers, right? I don't want thinkers. I want workers. And at the time for the Industrial Revolution, that made sense, but the school system didn't change after that. So the school system is designed to create workers, not thinkers. It's designed to create people who just like process and just do processes, right? Build this thing and get this thing done. So for everyone who's ever grown up in the modern school system, it's a product of John D. Rockefeller's desire to get work done, right? So if you want names and addresses for the they who created apathy, I think that's one strand in the DNA of our system that created the apathy, right? We have worker bees. So that's just to what we were talking about.
Yeah, and so John D. Rockefeller is not somebody I can reach out and touch right now because he's no longer with us. But this is the point. Like, if we're going to change our mentality from apathetic to participatory, it's important to know who you're dealing with and what you're engaging in. Because, and I think this, and this will lead into, just not to get too off the beaten path, this will lead into the section that you were talking about, being participant in your local community. Like, if you don't know who your if you live in a small town, you don't know who your mayor is, you don't live in a small town. You're just a resident of that town. You just kind of exist there. You're maybe a bedroom community kind of person. You should participate in the areas of influence that you have. We ought. There you go, moral component. But that was a very poorly worded way of saying something that we can, I'm sure we're going to get into a minute. So going back to the names and faces issue is that the infamous they is a bit of a problem, because if somebody is doing something, then there is a person to ascribe to that problem. And namely, let's use an example of this one. Like my family moved out of Minnesota not too long ago, a couple years ago. Now, who's on the city council? I don't know. I probably should have known. Now, in retrospect, I really should have known. But the people who were on the city council just have driven Minneapolis into the ground. And Minneapolis is the example of what happens when you create societal apathy. And I think that it's a good warning sign. Like, if you need a shock to your system, go to Minneapolis, go to Uptown, and walk through the areas that were looted, and walk through the areas that were part of the riots. That is what happens, and you will see now what happens when apathy takes over, because there was an event, and then the apathy The people of Minneapolis have been successfully subjugated through the use of apathy. But I'm going to get back to, I need to go back a layer. No, not I need to go back. I need to go forward a layer. And so apathy is an example of an intellectual casualty. If somebody has become apathetic, they are wounded. Like a soldier who's taken a bullet to the or an arrow to the knee. Let's use that as an example. And if we can heal that, that's where we start. So go ahead.
I would just say that maybe I would reword, something in that, which is that people haven't become apathetic. They've just been so inundated about caring about the wrong things.
Sure.
Yeah, like they and by proxy they're apathetic to their local stuff, but really they care a lot about, you know, mass invasion that's happening in our country, or they care a lot about, you know, Ukraine getting so much funding, or, you know, like all these other things that people are caring about. I don't know. I would maybe reel back some of my own words and just change what I had said about the apathy and just say that maybe it's apathetic by proxy because we're caring about these larger topics.
You're expending
a distraction.
Yeah. What is it? I can't remember the name of the law, the concept, but you can only have about 150 friends, roughly. Like right, a person right. Supposedly can only have about 150 people that they have a certain level of connection to. And then
the human mind actually only has – that's why – it's a part of the reason why phone numbers used to be 7 numbers and now they're 10. There was a study done during that time, and since then there have been more studies done where – they found that 7 numbers is about the RAM of the human mind. And at 7 numbers, your mind starts to calculate things differently. The way that they did the study, and I wish I had come more correct with this. I'll provide you some sources after this. But it was when NPR used to be good, this is where I first heard about it. And this was maybe 15 years ago or something like that. All this is to say, this study was they would give people three numbers, right? Let's say 2, 4, and 8, okay? Those are your 3 numbers. And then they would say, go from this room and then go to that room and recite the numbers. And they had thousands of college campus students doing this. They would sign up and it was some, you know, give you some credit or whatever. And they would go and they'd say, okay, your numbers are 1 and 3. Go ahead. Your numbers are 1 and 7 and 2 and 9. Go ahead. And they would go from one room, they would go to another room, and then they would recite the numbers. What they didn't know is that in between the two rooms, there was going to be someone that was there that was going to stop and say, hey, thank you for participating in today's thing. As a token of our appreciation, we've got some snacks for you to choose here. The snacks were a healthy snack, and the snacks were a like sweet treat. What they found over and over and over again throughout doing this study was that the people who had more numbers to remember chose sweet treats far more often than the people who had less numbers on their memory, who were able to make a healthy choice about what kinds of foods that they wanted. So that's to say that when people are inundated with too much information, our minds automatically are filled with too much junk to be able to make rational, logical, healthy decisions for ourselves, and we default by our sinful nature or by whatever other reason, we default to the lower vibrational choice, you know. And I think that that's an interesting study, not just on the capacity of, you know, the RAM of the human mind and how it affects our choices, but it's interesting to think about like what you were talking about earlier, which is that people are salaciously involved in, you know, the demise of the world, and it's easier to not mow your yard if you think that there's a nuke that's going to hit it tomorrow or whatever. It's like, all that's true. But there's actually science to back that up, to say that when we have our RAM is at max capacity in our mind, that we just can't even make another choice, you know. Mm. And it takes more effort to pull yourself out of that, and it takes even more work. And it also has to do with filtering out some of that stuff. You know, I only follow 300 people on Instagram. That's always been the case. I follow 300 people. And if I start to go above 300, I go through and I unfollow other pages. And I unfollow pages that either I don't resonate with anymore, or that I don't find useful to me anymore, or people maybe just not posting or whatever. But it's very intentional, because I only want to see those 300 creators. And by doing that, it makes it to where I'm not inundated. And I don't follow like too much. Most of what I follow is like DJs and artists and like that kind of thing. Very seldom am I following. I'm not following a bunch of like people in my echo chamber, you know, of like this world. I'm following people that I'm inspired by. You know, LaRussell is a musician right now on the West Coast, and he is a very high vibrational rap artist that is just a tremendous thinker and creator. So I'm following people like that, and that's where I get inspiration from. And so it's like by limiting the amount of content that I consume that's feeding back into some echo chamber, it's constantly challenging me and my creativity and the choices I make and in the way that I think. And I don't know that that's what most people do. I think people want to feel, you know, they want to be positively reinforced because they don't like to feel like they're crazy. They like to be amongst people who share their thoughts and beliefs. And that's totally natural. I don't blame anyone for doing that. But it just does take more work to unplug from the echo chamber and to plug into something else. And like you said, you know, we're only supposed to know 150 people.
I didn't say that we're only supposed to. I think it's on average the human mind can only maintain
the capability
about 150 friendships.
Right. Yeah, and so within that, you know, how does that look on the social media sphere? Like, well, then we should be maintaining, you know, if social media is ramping up our ability to process data and information, then if we are only supposed to or capable of having 150 friends, and we are only supposed to or capable of following 300 people, you know, and being very choosy about what those 300 are.
Curate what you feed your brain with, for sure.
Yeah.
Curation is key.
Absolutely.
And then, I mean, we're going to spiral very quickly. I mean, let's just spit through it real quick. Curation is key to a happy life, and curation forces the market to be able to function. It forces people to compete within a marketplace in a good way for a better product. We are competing for our highest values versus competing for our lowest values, yes. Which is effectively the argument of what you might expect there to be in an idea for moral capitalism, is that the moral value of capitalism is it forces us to compete for the best possible good. Now, that doesn't mean that people are going to do that. We might get people who in our environment, in our economy, who are trying to take advantage of that system, and they'll create an inferior product with a better marketing program, or they'll steal somebody else's stuff that we see all the time, IP and so on and so forth. But then this goes to show that an economy cannot sustain itself absent moral people, and so morality is required to exist alongside of it, whereas the idea that we would live in a world that could be somehow flattened would demolish the human spirit and turn us all into effectively zombies, or even worse, probably just argue for something like suicide, but we don't want to go down that far. So, no, excellent, though. So, the human mind can only hold on to about 150 relationships, like meaningfully. And then, and don't get me wrong, I'm sure there are exemptions, and everyone is the main character of the story. So fine, right. So be it. But what does that look like in application? I remember as a child growing up, and everyone in the church, and every once in a while you'd have the kind of like starving kids in Africa speech that would come up. And it wasn't necessarily from the pastor. There would just, like, it was like one of those things, like an MLM. It would just kind of travel around every once in a while, and you'd get like, oh, you donate $1 a day to starving kids in Africa. And it's an interesting problem because functionally, as a human being, I have no idea if that child that's on the picture with the flies on his face is even real. And I'm not saying that if I have abundance, it's not, there's not some good that might be accomplished. Like, I guarantee you, I'm not going to be going through and verifying where all the money's going, because I'm not giving money right now to starving kids in Africa. But the irony of it is that amount of energy let's call it mental capacity that you're spending to calculate and consider whether or not you should give $4.99 a month for whatever charity over wherever is also taking from something else. It's taking energy and mental capability that could be used over here, and it's now being spent evaluating whether or not this is a scam or drumming your emotions up or leaving you without. And the cry for a bit of, maybe call it decentralization, seems to be the human reaction to the it perhaps could be like an immune system reaction within society to excessive centralization and constant distraction by problems over there. Case in point that you brought up earlier was, if I can articulate the complexities of the Supreme Court decision of Heller versus DC, but I don't know who my children are being educated by. It's a misplacement of values. You can do both. And it's good to be able to do both, but it seems like there's a displacement of value if I have children and I don't know who's raising them, but I do know what's going on in the Supreme Court. We solve these problems locally. We can't solve these problems nationally in the way that we want to. We do
solve them nationally by solving them locally.
Excellent. We do. No, I think
that's what I'm positioning. You know, but the Free State Project in New Hampshire is solving a national problem by doing it locally. You know, I mean, I think that we just got it backwards. You know, we got it backwards on how we should tackle this thing, and that's why it seems like it's untackleable, because we're not doing it the right way. You know, you don't win a football game by, and I'm not a sports guy, so you know, I may be out of pocket even talking about this, but also sports are a massive distraction. And if you're a sports, I'm going to rip right here. If you're a sports guy and you know all of the different ins and outs about sports, and you spend an inordinate amount of time checking out the draft and watching sports and doing all that, but you're not engaged in your community, you have failed your family and you have failed your community. You know, the sports is a massive distraction, and there's nothing wrong with having hobbies and liking stuff, but sports is one of those things, dude, that's like an infection. And I witness people who are into sports, and I just look at it as an outsider, and it's really terrifying the grip that sports has on the American man and on how he functions within his other group of men that are within his life, and how he lets it rule his family. And if you are into sports, please do not infect your children with that, because it's absolutely ridiculous. Like sports, go to games, be involved in it at a surface level, much like anything else. But if sports is consuming you, to me, it's as bad as gambling or something like that. But anyway, sports.
I'm gonna add on to that, though, dude. I get it, though. I get it, because yeah, two dudes talking to each other through a camera is a weird way to approach it. But I think the criticism is pretty sturdy. Functionally, when it comes to people's belief system, sports seems to be the role of sports in America for some people seems to have been the intersection or the connection of religion and tribe. So you have like, and I think it's, this isn't a bad thing. There are good things that I'll use it just as an example. You can take anything and that can grip a person and put them into a community, and it will accomplish the same thing, because sports, you've got teams, you get to participate with people, common knowledge, it's social. These are good things. Playing the game, learning to work.
Participating in sports is great.
You know, but not only the participating, but like the business around it. Like, let's just use college football in the Deep South.
Sure.
Right. And, you know, it's like, yes, I get it. There's a certain amount of fervor behind it, but give it its credit. It deserves its credit. And that is, these people are brought together, or they have common language. They have a sense of tribe and community. They have rivalry that should, at least we believe, stay below the lethal line. But oops. But the problem that we have an issue is, I think the problem that you're saying is the same problem that I want to diagnose with the way that we treat the news, is that as Americans became, as Americans in the last 100 years, maybe 120 years, when we can talk about Nietzsche and the death of God, we can talk about secularism, and how the secular age changed the mechanism of belief and faith away from a worldview, or away from being faith and belief at all, was changed from being, I don't even know what you could say, and I don't have a strong reference point right now. Maybe B.B. Warfield and the Princeton Fathers about faith, belief and faith was a life-consuming event, or a life-consuming worldview, whereas faith in the secular age became, and I'm talking about faith specifically in terms of religion, became something that is just measured by authenticity. It's not about rationalism anymore. It's not about whether I act it or live it or participate it. It's just authentic. And so belief then diminished amongst the West, and it was replaced by social justice and social activities and the civil rights movements. It was invaded. It was this void was created in the West as the population just kind of, I will say, in a grand scheme, the West had sort of had an identity crisis, but also just stopped. Like Great Depression, stopped believing, grasping for a sense of meaning, grasping for a sense of reality, and things rushed in to fill that void. You can go back even further into history and talk about things like sensus divinitatis, and people have a desire or a need to. There is something about being human that needs to worship something. And when we turned our back on God and we turned our back on faith and real commitment, something filled that void. And it might have been the Industrial Revolution or industrialization. It might have been sports. It might have been the civil rights movement. It might have been feminism. It might have been whatever, right? Politics, the news. And so the news replaced the role of the preacher and the community in our lives. And so just like some people, just like it is possible for a person to be too invested into sports, it is possible for someone to be too invested identity-wise into the news.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I brought up the whole sports thing, but I'm glad that you expanded on that. Yeah, because anyway, we'll have a sports conversation, I'm sure, later. But I brought the sports thing up because you do not win a sports ball game by looking at all 9 innings, right? You do 1 inning at a time. You know, in football, it's 1 yard at a time. That's how a game is won, right? Mm-hmm. Not by all 4 quarters. And it mm-hmm. seems as though, because whether it be the news cycle or whether it be, you know, it's just the most sensational stuff is just what rises to the top. And so people are kind of naturally gravitating towards looking at the game from, like, you know, before they ever even got on the field, and just being like, well, how are we supposed to win all 9 innings? You know, it's like you're looking at it wrong, you know? And so we were going even back further than that, talking about that, you know, getting involved at the community level, at the local level, is how you make a change on the national level. That's how this whole thing was set up to work by our founding fathers. So yes, if we want to be constitutionalists, we want to, everyone knows everything about constitutional carry, but then they don't want to act about on any of the other constitutional foundations upon which this country was built or how it's supposed to run. But if we want to be constitutionalists about this, we have to first focus on our local communities, make a change there. And that is ultimately how we affect change elsewhere. And we cannot be distracted by the Ukraine spending bill when in all reality, you know, it's not affecting your, I mean, okay, it is affecting your local GDP, or it is affecting, you know, the inflation rates locally. Like, I'm not saying it's not affecting your community, but I'm saying that there's other ways to get involved and to have a larger effect on your community that the Ukraine yeah. spending bill has nothing to do with, right?
Well, I think there's a criticism that's underlying this conversation, and I think that criticism has to come out in a bit of a narrative format. And I'm going to use this as an example. I'm going to try to put this together as best as I can. But if you're looking at the West or America from the 30,000, only from the 30,000 foot level, where, or the 9 innings level, and you're looking at it and saying there is so much that needs to happen in this country or whatever, or it's all bad, it's all going to hell in a handbasket, because all 9, when I look at all 9 innings, when I look at the whole thing, there's no way that it can be fixed. That is a fertile field for not only conversation about civil war, but civil war tends to be the answer, because how do you fix all 9? How do you fix the whole country, all 9 innings of the country? You do it in a civil war, because that's so right. big and so total. Yeah. That, like, that's the only way that we can do it. You might even say, like, a great reset, or a factory reset, or whatever it is. We need to go back to default factory modes. We need to go back to the Constitution. It's like, okay, then do constitutionalism in your own state, in your own community. And I think, and I'll use this as an example. I think the city that I live in was the first city to, like, officially, they passed some useless piece of paper that I saw, and I saw an article on it, but it was they passed some useless piece of paper that basically condemned the war in Israel against Gaza or whatever. Like it effectively was like this state, the city of blah 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 declares that there shouldn't be that like it was some stupid thing. I don't even know how to go so far into it, but like, okay, so we have DC passing spending bills, we have issues in our local community, but I don't know how to say it another way. Be encouraged to participate locally. We don't, not only do we not want a civil war in the sense of we don't want the carnage and the ugliness of it, or we don't want the aftermath of it, but there is a certain amount of humility required to say that we don't actually want war.
Be at least aware. Like participation, that's the goal, but at least be aware of what's happening within your community. You know, because the situational awareness of what's going on in your city is huge and it matters. We talk about, you know, situational awareness all the time at restaurants or whatever. That also spans out into your community. You know, that's a tactical advantage you have. Like, so when I went to my city council budget meeting this last session that they had, the topic at hand was flock cameras. So the chief of police, Chris Cook, he's an amazing guy, and I really like Chief Cook as a person, you know, but and I understand why he wants flock cameras, right? I fundamentally disagree with them, and I raise a lot of questions about who has access to the flock cameras, where's that data sold, you know, questions that like he had not really thought about, because his job is not necessarily to dive into all those things. His job is to see like what is the net benefit of this system for our citizens.
I think
So my
I'm gonna have to tell you to peel back a second. You need to describe what these cameras are because.
absolutely, sure. So a flock camera is a camera that goes in and around your city, and what it does is they constantly monitor license plates and traffic for anybody that's passing through. And they're typically and only often used, or at least said to be used, for like hit and runs. So if there's a hit and run that happens, and somebody takes off, they can go back into a flock camera. They know the license plate of the hit and run at least. They can go through and they can check to, or if, let's say somebody only knows the color of the car that hit and ran, right? It was a red car or a red truck. They can go into the flock camera system and they can pull up red trucks, and they can see every red truck that passed through an area between this time and this time, because your license plate is attached to your VIN number. Your VIN number has all of that information in a database. Whenever you, that's why they make you register your car, right? And all these things. And so a flock camera is a camera that integrates with the registration database for all the vehicles in your area, and it's constantly monitoring, you know, all the different vehicles that are passing through an area. So it's most commonly used for stolen cars and hit and runs. However, it is constantly getting that data. Okay. So that's a problem. And less of the data collection, I mean, the data collection is a huge red flag, but also like who has access to it is another red flag, you know. And
And it, not only who has access, but who could have access.
who could have access, and what? How is that access being used? These are all the questions that I was asking that no one could really provide me answers for, but at least someone was there asking them. Now, ultimately, it got approved, right? I don't have the numbers yet. We're working on it. There's a locals-only group chat within the grid-based Discord, and we are trying to build numbers here to make effectual change in our community, but it takes a long time, right? And so, but at least being able to sit down with Chris, and to express these things and to express my concern about flock cameras, and to be able to do that. And you know what? Even though I was not successful in preventing their purchase and use, I gained intel about my area. So now I know flock cameras are in use in my area. And that's about the time when GridBase started selling the license plate covers. So if you go back and look, we used to offer license plate covers that with the touch of a button, it would drop down and it would cover your license plates. That's about the time I was like, okay, well, if they're gonna go flock cameras, I'm gonna go license plate covers. So we fix that right here. You know, if that's the way that they're getting the data, then we can fix that. And so, you know, was able to make some changes and do some things like that. So when I'm coming into my area and I know there's flock cameras, I shut my license plate down and then I go home. I just don't personally like there being data about where I'm coming and going at a local municipal level. It's not their business, you know?
There's a huge issue there, not with you, huge. But there's a huge issue with the idea of the surveillance state.
Like, well, and there's Florida's, you know, a lot of people are doing this kind of stuff. They're using AI enhanced microphones to determine when a shot rings out and to geolocate where that gunshot was.
There's a whole bunch of
shot spotter in Florida. Florida has like shot spotters all over the whole state. And so there's all kinds of systems like this that are in use, you know, and if being involved at a local level does anything, and this is why, you know, you had said to participate, right? And I said if not just to participate, at least be aware, because mm-hmm. if being involved at a local level, even in not a participation role yet, but at least in an awareness role to start out, see, it can't hurt you. It cannot hurt you in how you approach, you know, your day-to-day life within your city.
Not only let's we're kind of on a maybe almost like a de-pessimism slope. Now it sounds like a weird combination of words, but it's kind of like we're talking about a concept about having a misplaced set of values and then trying to correct that. But I think there's something, instead of looking at this in purely a negative sense, perhaps there's something more, let's call it inspiring, which is participation in your local community leads to greater opportunities for participation. For he who is granted with little, or he who is faithful with little, much will be granted.
Wow.
And so the motivation can be multi-pronged, but at the beginning, it's you don't have to fix your life. You don't have to fix the world. You got to make it through the day, and you need to you sometimes focus a little closer to home and then let that world expand outwards, right? instead of trying to fix the world, you know. Yeah. Like, start, this is me lecturing myself. Like, I've read a number of books now that are very clear that the author is writing to himself. And perhaps I need to take that lesson to heart. But no, I think this is a really great place to be, and I think it's a great, like, it's a great place to look at it. And I think you've led by examples. The infrastructure problem, we'll use those cameras again. Was it about a year ago? It was a whole bunch of people in France started going around cutting down all their traffic cameras. They were
I thought it was London, but maybe it was France too.
Maybe it was London, because London, yeah. Have you ever been to London?
I have.
Yeah. So, you know what you know what it's like, how much surveillance there is in that city. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
I went a long time ago, but there still was a ton of surveillance in the city. Yeah, it was still even very old London.
Let's see. It was my wife and I once traveled to London, France, and Italy. And we spent about a month in that whole in between those three countries. And then we came home. And about a year later, I received something in the mail saying that I owed the city of blank money for a traffic violation. So we flew across the world to Europe. We traveled. We rented a vehicle. We traveled this way here. We traveled this way here. We traveled this way there. And at one point in time, we rented a vehicle, and we drove from one city to another city. And along the way, we stopped because we were trying to figure out how to basically get somewhere. We parked the car, got out of the car, saw that there was a no parking spot. It was like a no parking sign. Got back in the car and drove away. A year later, we received a ticket from that city for parking at a non-parking spot.
Wow.
For like 5 minutes.
Wow.
To figure out, we literally went to, it was, this is how simple it is. We got out of the car, walked down the road, saw the sign. It was in Italian. We translated it to English. No parking between this time. Got back in the car and drove away. And I'm like, oh, wow. Okay. But and a year later, we got a ticket. And so that sounds like a human inconvenience. But what is so much more, I think what you're talking about in that sense, and I think what we can address in this issue is the reason one of the main issues that this camera concept has a problem, we have a problem with, is when the world is quote unquote at peace, that's fine. But what happens when somebody has access to that camera system, can search for vehicles? Maybe they want to find your license plate. Now they build a pattern of life on you, or they have a computer that's already built up. You have a profile now. You have a profile on a cloud that tracks your movements, that knows what your pattern of life is, that he drives from this spot to this spot every day, he crosses this intersection every day at this time to this time. Now you have all the data you need for doing bad things to each other. It's so simple now. You've just,
and look, I'm not even saying that Flock. Here's another aspect to what you're saying. Okay, mm-hmm. So 23andMe or Ancestry, like them in and of themselves were great companies. Sure, they had a mission to connect people with their ancestry so that people felt more connected. Great, and they did that by processing DNA and doing all this stuff. They were collecting data. Mm-hmm. For this one particular purpose. Now, I've never spoken with the founders of these companies, but I would imagine that originally it probably started out pretty altruistic. However, BlackRock then acquired these companies. So it's like, even if the company is doing something good, right? Let's say that the Flock traffic cameras are only accessed and used for this one purpose, but the data is still there. Who's to say that another company can't come in and buy that company out for a tremendous amount of money that they can't say no to, and then now they have all the data? We just don't – data collection in general is super weird, and we don't know the long-term results of that data collection. Just expanding upon your point, you know, here, which is that, like, this data collection allows you to build a picture of somebody or whatever, but, like, even if that company doesn't want to, what about the second or the third or the fourth company that buys it? What's their intention? We have no idea. Mm-hmm.
So data collection is a big, what I'm saying problem is, it's not a big problem as in it's a problem that needs to be fixed. It's a problem that, like, it's a big concept.
Yes.
Really big. It's very huge in the sense of phones, computers. We're talking over the internet. We have microphones and everything now, cameras everywhere, driving to go to the grocery store. I'm going to get hit by 17 different cameras, whatever. Right. All this kind of stuff is going. All that information is going somewhere. It's getting used for some purposes. We don't have any answer to. We probably as individuals do not have the capacity. I do not know if individual human beings have the capacity by simple mental, like, overload, whatever the mental capacity of an individual is, to comprehend in the amount of data that's being collected on them at any given time at a comprehensive, at a complete level. In other words, I don't think that there is. I think what I'm trying to say is there's so much data being collected on us as individuals that we are not capable of comprehending the level of that data collection at any given time. We have to break it up into parts. We have to break it up into components, just like we cannot.
Perfect segue here, which is that if you're looking at it from the 30,000 foot view, it's too much to tackle. But if you're doing it at a local level and a small level, it's something that you can have a part of. Right. So
exactly.
Going back to the Flock cameras thing, it's like, yeah, I cannot control what's happening with all of the data that I might be subjected to, or the data mining that might be subjected upon me, but I at least have some sort of control over about whether or not my city puts Flock cameras in, you know, and then by that I have an opportunity to, you know, make some sort of effectual change, even if people don't even care or know. Like it's not for that, you know, it's for me.
Now, what is that?
My fundamentals.
What does that concept look like when it comes to what you do for grid base?
Yeah, so like that's what it's all about. Like at my peak, I'm going to take my phone and I'm going to throw it as far as I can and I'm never going to need it again. Okay? I'm going to have Pocket, I'm going to have Base Station, I'm going to be able to use those for any information that I ever would need, and I'm going to have my radios to be able to communicate with my wife and my son and anyone else. And I've told my mother this too. If you want to call me, you need to get into ham radio. You're going to have to figure this out, because there's not going to be a way for you to contact me otherwise here in the near future. I've told her this two or three times now. And my friends know this too. I've told all of them, like, hey, like, this is a fun thing right now, but, like, understand that there's going to come a point when my son's about 3 or 4 years old where I am no longer going to have a phone. And if we want to maintain a relationship, this is what it's going to look like, you know, or pen pals, which of course you and I have already started. And so it's like doing those kinds of things. Like, that's how I will maintain relationships and communication by then. So it's like what I'm doing through Gridbase is trying to facilitate a medium for other people to access this level of freedom and decentralization. But it's a part of my DNA of what I'm doing as well. And eventually I'll have somebody running the business. I'll have contact with them, and that will be how that goes, you know, and then that'll be it.
That's I can barely, but still, I can see it, but only barely. And I see, this very, very intriguing future for you.
We already have a property set up that we're talking about transitioning to here within the next few years. So when I get over to that property, everything that I need, my community, my farm, like all of that's being set up right now. My mother-in-law and my father-in-law are out there now, and they work the farm. We have a successful farm out there, and it's growing. It's been fruitful now for multiple years, you know? So it's like, that's happening. They trade and barter and make relationships with other people in the community for meat, since we don't have cattle or goats or chickens or anything like that right now. So they trade vegetables and fruits and all those things for freezers full of meat. And so it's like, there's already, that ecosystem is already in place up there, you know? Yeah. And when we're ready, when I'm ready to quit my day job and plug in up there, we're so doing that. And then at that point, it is not necessary for me to be encumbered by all the things of this world. You know, it's just not necessary. And if I need to tap into my email, you know, I'm sure that I will. If I need to tap into world news, if there's something happening, I'm sure that I will probably end up getting that over HF radio before anyone else gets it. But if for some reason I need to do that, you know, on the interwebs, I'll be able to do that. But it's really not, it's not hard. It's just where you're putting your efforts. You know, my wife and I always have a saying, and I'm going to butcher it now because I'm on camera and I forget it, but basically to the effect of like, did you not have the time or did you not make the time? You know, like which is it? Whether it's like, did you not make the time to do that? Or did you genuinely not have the time? 9 times out of 10, you just didn't make the time. You didn't make the effort. You didn't carve it out that way. And so my wife and I keep each other accountable with that. And so, you know, for us and for just this decentralization and this future that I'm talking about where I'm headed towards, it's every single thing that I am doing, my entire intentions in how I make my money, in the cars that I buy, in the relationships that I have, like, you know, every single endeavor to my core, like it's all leading to that. You know, because I don't want all of the stuff that I've been told that I have to have, because I just fundamentally don't believe that I have to have it. Now, I do recognize the fact that I have to use it to get the privilege of not having to have it, right? Like, I have to use Instagram. I had to advertise for my business. I had to make the contacts. We have to shoot this video right here over the internet, right? Like, mm-hmm. I understand that in order for me to get to that place, it's requiring this. But the other day, I was driving out in the country. I was probably 3 hours away from my house. I was pretty far out there. And I just thought it was so funny because my wife and I, you know, we're talking about starting a farm and you know, we're talking about putting chickens and goats on the farm out there in Oklahoma. And it's just a funny conversation because as I was driving through the country, the nearest store was over an hour and a half away. My wife and I always talk about the garbage that they put in grocery stores and how just terrible it is and, you know, how difficult it is to find healthy food in grocery stores. And it's just, it was so funny to me because what is like a lifestyle choice for us is just a way of life for people that are only 2 or 3 hours away from me. Like, they go into the store once a month to get toilet paper and, like, you know, chicken feed or whatever, you know, but sure. They were one farm in particular that I drove past had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of goats. I promise you they're only drinking goat milk. I promise you that they're only eating eggs that their chickens laid. I promise you that they're eating those goats whenever they can. And I promise you that they're trading and bartering that stuff for other stuff that they need. So it's like, but for them, for the child raised there, or for the dad who has had that place for a long time, it was obviously a very old installation. It wasn't a new money farm. It was an old installation. It was an old farm. There was a John Deere 4020 that was there, which if you don't know, is a very old tractor. There was not any new tractors on this farm. It was old tractors and old equipment. So they've been there for a very long time. And for them, there was no other way to live. So it's really interesting because, like, we have this conversation. Interesting is such an annoying word, and I'm sorry that I used it, but it's fascinating.
It's unfortunate.
It's unfortunate that for some of us, we've grown up into where this has to be a lifestyle choice for us, and it's, like, hard for us to imagine or fathom. But for people today, right now, less than 2 or 3 hours away from me, like, that's a way of life that they've only known. There's still – and they're not Amish. They're regular people, you know? Yeah. And so it's not that far-fetched. And I think maybe like that's why I feel so empowered to do it, is because like I'm surrounded by that. I live in Texas. I live in rural Texas. So it's like I see people actively doing it. I was born in the city. My great-grandfather was feeding his turkeys off of somebody else's turkey feed. And that dude got upset and kicked him out to Fort Worth. They were way out in the pastures in Wise County back in the early 1900s. Kicked him out, and he had to go to Fort Worth. And when he went to Fort Worth, he became a commissioner of in Tarrant County, and they paid him in land. And so anyway, my family, that's how my family ended up in Fort Worth, and I've been here for a very long time. Probably maybe a curse, right? Maybe a curse because he was feeding his turkeys and then selling those turkeys off of somebody else's feed. That was not a moral thing to do. But for whatever reason, we ended up here. And so now I have to work to undo the effects of that and to get my family back out there and plugged in back out there. But it's very doable, and there's a whole community of people doing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's multiple generations of – that doesn't make the right sense. I know that what I was trying to say is there's this this motif, I don't know how to, there's another word for it. There's this constant reoccurring theme that I experience amongst people in our milieu, for sure. Some of them are people who are directly involved in the industry or the business or the kind of things, that, the people that we rub shoulders with. But then there's also people who are outside of that. And the idea is very simple. It's let's move to a small town and live a simpler life. And build our town. Let's go build our town, kind of thing. And it might be get some land, start bartering, be self-sufficient, not be so busy and caught up in the hustle and bustle of the city. Have some sense of self-sufficiency. Only really deal with the people that we want to deal with. Sort of. Maybe that's not the right way of saying it, but you know what I'm talking. Like this. Yes. This idea is not
that is the right way of saying it. By the way, yeah.
Like it's not, this idea is not unusual. It's not, it's also not, I wonder how old it is, right? If you go back to like 1704 and you find Mr. and Mrs. Smith in London and or wherever, and they're like, ah, this London life is, this big city life is not for me. Let's go on a ship and go to the New World. I wonder how much of that is, or if you go back further and you're like, Constantinople ain't it, dude. Let's go, you know, go settle. Let's get some of our friends and go move to this country that eventually becomes Albania or whatever it is. Right. You know, like the Greeks were unsatisfied with Athens, and so they went to Troy. But I wonder how old that worldview or that sort of calling is. Yeah. But at the same time, I look at the letters that I have on my desk from people that I talk to, and the life choices that some people that I know are making, and it really does seem like that is a desire. It's been a common desire. I know multiple generations of people who have talked about at some point in time in their life they moved away from the city and they wanted their friends to move around where they bought land and they wanted to build their own little town, but it never happened. And it's the same story generation after generation after year after year after year. I've heard it 1,000 times. Wouldn't it be great if we all bought like 200 acres together in and then built our own community, but I've never seen it done. And the reason why, I think there's a couple reasons why it's never done. One is that it requires a certain thing that I don't think is good. And that is, I don't think people should go in and buy land together as families, because there are things that change in our life. Let's say I bought land, like I went in with my friend and we bought 100 acres.
I've seen it happen. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
we bought 100 acres, and then I have a sickness in the family, and I can't sustain that land. I choose not to sustain that land anymore, and I go back to living, or go back to moving somewhere else to take care of the family. Like, that's you're putting people, you're tearing them between two goods. And
well,
so, and
it's happening right now on legacy farms. So, like, I have a buddy who has almost 1,000 acres in Wise County, and like, there's multiple families that live on it. They've lived on it for over a century, right? Mm-hmm. And right now, there's like this conversation happening about like, hey, what are we going to do with the farm? And it's actually a systemic issue, because so they're having this issue on their property, but other families were having this issue on their property and they decided to sell. And so now, like, right next to their large piece of property is a whole bunch of McMansions that have been built.
Yep.
You know,
exactly.
It's a Yellowstone thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's like this thing where it's like, okay, so this idea is happening on the farm itself, but it's also happening within the rural communities itself of like, well, what do we do? And, you know, how do we maintain this? And, you know, so yeah, going out and doing what you're talking about it's difficult for the new people that are going out to the rural lifestyle, but it's also a difficult thing to do for people who've only known the rural lifestyle. You know, it's tough.
Well, you and you're going to run into a decision matrix problem. Dude, you're going to have to figure out one way or another. You either have to deal with the shit that you live in the cities, pardon my language, or you're going to have to figure out the problems of moving away and finding out how to do it. The other
choose
part
your
about-
heart. Choose your heart. You know?
Yeah, choose. I mean, it's not going to be easy, but choose which one you want to take. Just
choose
do
your
it.
Heart.
And I think this might not be. This may not come across as inspiring. This may not come across as inspiring, but I don't. It is nonetheless true. If you're desperate for a sense of adventure, but you're not willing to step out the door, you are not the hero of the story. You are the victim.
Yeah,
and that is partially stolen from Joseph Campbell with The Hero of 1,000 Faces.
Joseph Campbell, man, respect to that dude. Goodness gracious, I love him. He's foundational for me. The Power of Myth changed my life.
I have not read that one.
I've read it, and he did a documentary with Bill Moyers at George Lucas's ranch, and it was on PBS, and you can go and access and watch that right now, and it's incredible. He talks about the book The Power of Myth, and that was how I was introduced to it and then read it later. But wow.
Yeah, well, myth in a sense is an interesting way. It seems like the psychologists and of his type, followed by Campbell and in our era Peterson, are grasping at something foundational to our world that was abandoned in Darwinism, basically. Like, it's not really, I'm looking at the book as I'm kind of talking to you, but it was interesting reading The Hero with 1,000 Faces, because Joseph Campbell very clearly is trying to argue for something that he cannot produce. And that is he sort of abstracts the concept of God and belief to this like subconscious infinity, almost infinite subconscious, almost. And it's interesting that the book I think it's a must read, especially for men. Like, and I only say that for men, because I'm not saying that it's a men versus women thing. I'm saying it because, like, as a man, I think men should read it. They ought read it. It's a good read. Even if it's hard to read, just read it. Like, geez, dude, are you going to be beaten by a book? Like,
right.
You know, like, I guess I don't know how to say that any other way than, like.
It's not House of Leaves.
I don't even know what that is.
House of Leaves? Oh, yeah. Wow. You got to check that book out. It's a trip. It is a trip. It's not a good read, and you will rightfully get beaten by that book. It's ridiculous. As he's falling down the stairs, the words are changing on the page, and you're like rotating the book. It's just insane.
Yeah. It's a little art housey.
It's very art housey. Yeah.
Good for them. So good. I mean, you know, cool. Thanks.
Yeah.
But Hero with the Thousand Faces in the book, he traces myth, and he traces what he calls the monomyth that all mythological stories follow. It's good to read in pairing with Wild at Heart by Eldridge. Read one then the other. But where he struggles and where the book, like, it's interesting. All of the chapters are really good, except for the last three pages just completely suck. That's the only thing that I remember about the book, or one of the things that I remember about it. Like gripping, well-written academia from front to beginning about how all of these myths follow the same arc. They have these common archetypes. There's a commonality between them. The monomyth is the term that comes from there. And at the end, he's trying, you can see where the end of Joseph Campbell happened, where he's trying to fill a void, which is what is all this for and what is all this pointing at? And it just doesn't land. But that doesn't, and it's interesting, and I bring that up to say, the book is still a must read, even if that's how it ends, because it's not gonna, the pages one through all but the last three might change your life a bit, but the last three probably won't. And it's interesting. So it's a foundational book on the bookshelf for sure.
Yes.
But what that points to, though, and I think we've almost recreated some of the conversation or the writing that takes place in that book in the conversation that we've had, because we talked a little bit earlier about the level of dissatisfaction is disproportionate to the level of dysfunction in our country, as in there's more dissatisfaction than there is dysfunction. And then we talked about that in decentralization covered political decentralization, and then it went into technological decentralization. And then, so we have this kind of common theme of decentralization and movements, and then farms and families, and then we also have to do with faith and how I know this may be a little bit grand narrative-y, but I think much of the spiritual pain that people are experiencing in our worldview, or in our world, in our day and age in 2024, is the result of essentially 100 years of opulence, where the mechanism of belief could be diminished into something as minimal as authenticity, and that it produced all of the horrors of the 20th century, whether it's the mass killings by communist countries and the invasion of that empty worldview into academia, but it also survived on a bounty, whether it was the Industrial Revolution, the technological revolution, the information age, the post-information age, and now are the thing that is causing the most distinct suffering in the West comes down to, we have invested in empty gods and they have left us destitute. And those empty gods are wealth and politics. And that's where we're at. I would
in a layman's term say we've lost individualism. We've lost individuality in thinking. You know, we talked about the decentralization of tech and all these other things, but it's like decentralizing your mind, you know, and unplugging from like everything that you're being programmed into believing and thinking and seeing, and being an individual and thinking individual thoughts and coming up with pragmatic solutions to immediate problems or challenges within your vicinity.
I don't think we're struggling with individualism in that sense. We have these things called main character syndrome. I don't know if I agree with you.
I think we can see it in product. Like, everything's a regurgitation. Like, every movie is just a remake of an old movie.
Yeah.
So it's like, as a society, like, the individualism, we don't have, like, a whole lot of original individual ideas and thinkers. It's a whole lot of people who are jumping on a bandwagon of an idea that was already thought of. And I think it presents a challenge to think an individual thought when we're so concerned with this larger collective idea, as we talked about earlier. You know, everyone's quick to be like, hey, the world's ending, the world's ending, the world's ending, the world's ending, the world's ending. And yeah, the world's ending.
Okay.
And it's easier to do that than it is to say, like, no, it's not. We just need to get involved.
Well, we need to break that down a little bit, because are you just describing specialization in a negative tone? For example, let's talk division of labor, right? There are a very small amount of people who are doing good philosophy in the world. There are a very small amount of people who are doing we'll use Harvard as an example, right? The president of Harvard is steps down, not because she's a massive plagiarist and probably a racist, but because she didn't support the current thing the right way. But that's supposed to be a localization of specialization. And what I mean by specialization is you're going to have thought leaders in every regard, and you're going to have, or in every discipline, you're going to have thought leaders in every discipline. You're going to have some people who are the best at something because we live in a specialized environment. And so it makes sense for me. I don't need to be a mechanic, a doctor, a lawyer, a plumber, a construction worker, a roofer, I don't have to do all these things. So I'm going to lean towards an expert in some direction all the time. I except for the things that I have expertise in. And so what we're experiencing in our world that is, at least in our environment, that's attempting at decentralization again, what we've recognized is that the people who exist in those positions of authority, who should be the leaders of these institutions and these practices and these disciplines and these skills, not only are they just failing at it, but they are the antithesis of the values of that system. Namely, we're going to go into academia. We should be building our own universities. We should be building our own colleges, where if you attend the college and you say, and you do a plagiarism, you no longer attend the college. Or if you are engaging in the study of something and your fundamental thesis is the thing doesn't exist, then you no longer are allowed to study. You're removed from that environment, because you cannot argue plumbing with people who don't believe in pipes. And we cannot, and if your fundamental worldview, maybe in the study of history, is based on like the 1619 project, you're no longer considered a historian. You're not allowed to teach in front of children. You're removed from our society. Like, not saying we, you know, go do the violent thing, but it just, we do not need to appeal to people who do not believe in the principles of the thing to have a position of authority of the thing. And that's the really, I'm saying this so complicatedly, but
you're saying that at the top, that from the top down, there's a, people are just following protocols and processes and procedures to gain favor within whatever societal structure they're in to keep their job or whatever. And so at the top, these people, as you've mentioned, the director of Harvard, like, because she at the top is not doing her job, then everyone underneath her is failed by her poor leadership. And that's to be said about the military, or that's to be said about politics or anything else, that the people at the top are not leading in the correct way to allow people to, underneath them, to function correctly. Is that what you're saying?
I think that we're living in a really weird time where we know that the leaders are not functioning properly. And what I mean by not functioning properly is that I'm not saying that they're simply making a mistake and trying to figure out the complexities of life. It's that they're being in that position is the antithesis of the values of that position.
Yeah.
So again, we're going to go back to the former president of Harvard. She plagiarized her. She is a mass plagiarist. It is known, it is researchable, it is identifiable, it is observable. So there is no world in which we should be listening to her talk about literally anything. She should be a checkout. No, that's a disgrace for people who work in in retail. But she should not be allowed, like, she should not be employed. And what is worse is the people who gave her a job, the people who were responsible for her academic rise, should also be looked at with suspicion. Every student who has attended Harvard during her tenure should be suing the school for every single dollar that they gave that school. Absolutely. And it should come out of her bank account, and then it should come out of the school's bank account. But what I'm saying this, and that's probably the most aggressive way of saying it, but the world that we live in, and the world that we're living in right now, is that you and I are existing in, because neither of us are in high academia right now, are in a very odd place where we know that the people who are in these positions of authority in our world of specialization are not only not capable of doing the job, but they are an antithesis of that job. But we are not working to find a way out of it. Well, at least culturally. Maybe it's even more myself. Maybe that is the criticism that needs to be leveled there. And so there's something wrong about that. In other words, we should not be satisfied with complaining. I will just throw the dagger right at myself. I should not be satisfied with criticizing the president of Harvard and the academic system for employing a person with that level of depravity into the seat of authority. I should be building a true academy where those kind of people cannot exist. Or should not, or were, right?
Yeah, that. Yes.
That's the part that I think is something that that is what I started to draw from your conversation even 6 or 4 months ago. But I wanted to pull from
that. Just that's what resonated with me just now with what you said.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah,
I'm really glad we got to this, because sometimes you have to just work through the process. But yeah. I should not be satisfied with the dysfunction of the system. And use that satisfaction, and in that satisfaction, justify bad behavior, right. Like, in that sense of dissatisfaction, justify bad behavior, and then the abandonment of my responsibilities as an individual. Wow. Okay. Well, yeah, now we got there. you've educated me. You've inspired me. This is fantastic.
Conversations, baby.
Do we even have the energy to pivot to a third or fourth topic, or do you think that's how we wrap it up, man?
Well, we do have the energy, that I am for sure. Do we have the time is a whole other question, because Daddy still works a day job. You know what I'm saying?
Gotcha. So
we got to go to work. I don't know that we have the time, but it's a great opportunity for us to table it, have our own private discussions, and come correct on the next one in another episode, because of course we can always do this again.
You know what? We're going to, though. And yes. I gotta thank you, man. I gotta thank you for in real time walking through this process of changing our, let's call it, disposition away from apocalyptic, and it's just quitting. Like it's
proactive solutions-based approaches. That's what I'm about. I don't want to sit here and talk about problems all day. You know, the problems are pretty immediately identifiable. You know what's wrong. You know, mm-hmm. What are you going to do about it? And I mm-hmm. think that's just, we could have long, long, long conversations about all the things that are wrong and why they're wrong. And this is not a criticism of philosophers at all, because, you know, the philosophers that are there are needed to be there. But it's not my job to be a philosopher. It's my job to be a foot stomper for solutions and to give people the language to round out what those solutions look like. And I do that because of philosophers, right? Because philosophers sit there and present different things that inspire me to come up with solutions for things. So, yeah, I want to see everyone come up with solutions for, you know, things within their independent community. And I want to hear more stories about what's happening at a local level. I want to, like you said, you know, let's get rid of the news agencies and let's have private reports about what's happening. Let's have our own Free State Project you know, let's get rid of ridiculous laws and let's get rid of ridiculous taxation. And we have examples such as the Free State Project in New Hampshire to reference for how they did it. It started in 2001, so it's only 20 years old and they've been this successful. Mm-hmm. So, you know, little by little, I believe that we can begin laying the bricks and the mortar that are necessary to start crafting a world that we want to be in. You know, and I want to encourage everyone to plug into thinking about what that looks like more. And I appreciate you for giving us the philosophical tools to be able to lay a foundation for what that looks like. And of course, for the platform to be able to talk about some of these larger ideas, because I think these conversations are happening at large in private circles. Like, I don't think me and you are the only ones that have talked about this. And in fact, when I talk about this topic with many other people have already thought of it. This isn't my own original idea. I think there's something in the ether where everyone's kind of tasting this. We're getting dissatisfied with the way things are and we want a new avenue. And I think that we will see, you know, the cream float to the top with these kinds of ideas in the near future. And this helps propel that idea forward. So thank you for the opportunity to have me on and for helping me work out at a more academic level, you know, what this idea looks like. Thank you.
No, dude, you're great. You're great. All right. Well, Jake, it's good having you on again. I look forward to our next conversation. Where can people find you? Where can they get plugged in with the work that you are doing?
Time to shine. So we have June 8th. We have a class coming up. It's an outdoor comms class. We have people flying in from Canada, California, all over the world to come to this class. It is an introductory level class. It is going to be fantastic. And it's right here in North Texas. There's going to be many elements to this class. Like I said, it's beginner friendly. So come one, come all. We're going to be discussing topics such as building your own antennas, you know, the actual fundamentals of what radio waves are. And we're going to help people in a practical way apply the principles that we've talked about in this podcast into their life. And we're doing that June 8th. So if you're interested in coming out to the comms class, please go check out www.gridbase.net. Of course, you can find us on Instagram at gridbase, D-O-T-N-E-T, gridbase.net spelled out. And we sell a litany of products, and all the links to those things are on the website or on the Instagram. Of course, we do have a YouTube channel as well. And so if you're interested in more long-form content about what we do, please be sure to check out the YouTube channel. The hats, I think I've got 10 left, so if you're interested in one of the limited edition Sad Ham hats from Gridbase, please go check that out. And otherwise, any other links or anything that you need, please just I use Instagram the most. That's where I'm at. Of course, we have a Discord, and we have all kinds of other avenues for people to plug in. And I do want to pump the Discord because there's so many different subsections within the Discord that if you have any questions about any of these one things in particularly, it's in the Discord. It's an amazing forum. And other people are there developing the community within the Discord. And it's awesome. We have 300 members there. And we have a podcast of our own, but it's currently deprecated as we build a catalog. So that will be coming back online shortly. But
I don't know how you do it, man. You have the energy. Like I am the amount of continuous creative energy of yours.
Well, thank you.
So
I do it with the support of my wife. I couldn't do anything that I'm doing without the support of my wife. Anything that you see that is good within me is because of Christ and my wife. So, yeah. And coffee. And, with those three things, I can accomplish it all. But yeah, man, the support of my wife is huge. You know, without her being right there next to me and supporting me in all these endeavors, I would have failed long ago. And of course, for Christ being the true North Star and what guides everything that I do. And glory be to God.
Glory be to God. All right. Christ is Lord. And with that, let's go forth and conquer.